All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center here in downtown Santa Monica. We have a great show for you today. Please be seated. When the Senate comes back from its recess this August, it's going to jump right away into hearings on President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, D.C. Circuit Judge Brett Kavanaugh. And we have with us from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who's been a great friend of the show, Camille Fisher. And she's the Frank Stanton Fellow with the EFF. And she, along with several of her EFF colleagues, have written and recently published an article questioning Kavanaugh about digital privacy and net neutrality that kind of outlines a series of questions that the committee members should explore with Judge Kavanaugh on his record and on certain key issues. And so we're glad to have Camille with us to talk about Judge Kavanaugh's record. Camille, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. Nice to be on.
Thank you for joining us. And Camille is a fellow Hoya lawyer graduating from Georgetown Law Center. And and for our listeners, you can, the show notes for today's show is as usual at our blog at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com, and follow us at cyberlawradio on Twitter. So we have a new wrinkle in the whole nomination process for Judge Kavanaugh, and that being with the conviction of the guilty plea of Michael Cohen, where he implicates President Trump. You have this cloud of illegitimacy hanging over the Trump presidency. And just this morning, you had Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono saying that she's canceled my meeting with Judge Kavanaugh at Real Donald Trump, who is an unindicted co-conspirator in a criminal matter, does not deserve the courtesy of a meeting with his nominee, purposely selected to protect, as we say in Hawaii, his own okole. And so it creates another element to what is somewhat of a strange nomination process already. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
You know, I mean, it's been an incredibly strange nomination process. I think that, I mean, what we're increasingly seeing over the last 2 years is significant distrust in the U.S. government as a whole. And so whether it's in this nomination process because some of Kavanaugh's records haven't been released to the full Senate, or whether it's because the president who has nominated him raises significant questions for some people about his actions and his lawyer and his campaign chairman's actions. It seems that there needs to be a larger release of records and a greater public process and transparency around the nomination to kind of bring back that trust.
So let's back up just a little bit. I think what Senator Hirono is referring to is some of Judge Kavanaugh's statements on the executive power, and that in particular, questioning whether a president can be subject to lawsuits or even criminal investigation, and his openly questioning the decision in the U.S., the unanimous decision of the Supreme Court in U.S. v. Nixon, where the court ordered Nixon to comply with a subpoena for the tapes that ultimately led to Nixon resigning. And I think there's suspicion that one of the plus factors for Kavanaugh being selected by President Trump was that if his battle with the independent counsel ever goes to Supreme Court, he's going to have a friendly judge on the Supreme Court.
I mean, definitely. It's always a little weary when one branch of government gives too much deference to another. So to have a judge on the Supreme Court that could potentially give more deference than judges have in the past to the executive branch is troubling. I mean, one of the foundational principles of the American rule of law is stare decisis, and the fact that judges should apply and continue the legal tradition and the rulings of the Supreme Court justices before them. So it will be really interesting to see how Kavanaugh kind of squares that up if he becomes a member of the court.
And one thing I take away from that is, if you're willing to question a unanimous ruling of the Supreme Court, and that to me suggests that this was someone who could be potentially be a judicial activist. That if something like that is not settled law to him, then everything's open game. But let's back up a little bit too and go over a little bit about his background, and which also comes into play as to some of the procedural controversy we're having now. So Judge Kavanaugh, who I think it was Senator Durbin in his first confirmation hearing called the Z-League of Republican politics. He a graduate of Yale. Actually, he's a Beltway veteran since he grew up in Bethesda. Graduated from Yale, went to work for the first Bush administration for Solicitor General Ken Starr. Then he clerks with Justice Kennedy, who he's now seeking to replace, and then from there he joins Starr again at the Independent Counsel's Office, where he actually helped write the Starr report, making the case for impeachment of Bill Clinton. He then jumps to a D.C. law firm where he's actually involved in the Elaine Gonzalez matter and even the 2000 Florida recount. He jumps back to the second Bush White House as an associate counsel and then eventually as staff secretary, where he is the lawyer that before every decision is made, make sure the process has been followed and that whatever paperwork the president needs to implement whatever decision he's made, it goes through him. And so he was involved in, that was a period, a very controversial period during the Bush administration. And when he was first, he was then later nominated for a D.C. circuit position. And his nomination was held up for a couple of years in part because of concerns about whether he was being truthful in saying that he was not involved in any deliberations in the Bush administration over the detentions at Guantanamo Bay and the torture policies, and which later would turn out not to be the case, that he actually had been involved, but that was only after he was confirmed. So that's the background. This is the guy who's been involved in practically everything. He was actually at the White House and on 9/11. So, I mean, all these major events happened from the early 90s to 2006, before when he was finally confirmed. He was kind of at the epicenter of what was going on in Republican politics, and so he gets confirmed and goes to the D.C. circuit, where he's been now for 12 years. And so, in addition to evaluating his record, there's a big question now about allowing the senator's access to his records during the Bush administration and during the nominations under President Obama for Justice Kagan and even Justice Sotomayor. For Justice Sotomayor, they went to great extents to even get board meetings of nonprofit organizations she'd been involved with so that they can have the minutes of those meetings available. And Kagan, I think it, you know, 95% of her records were produced, and we're at a position now with Kavanaugh when it's only 10% of those records have been produced, and 1/3 of which have been designated confidential for committee members only, but they haven't requested the records relating to his period as staff secretary for President Bush. And yeah. What's your take on that?
I mean, so I have to be a little careful because EFF's a nonpartisan organization.
Sure.
But we support transparency and government oversight. And it does seem like there's a huge discrepancy in the release of Kagan and Sotomayor's records. I know that Kagan, she worked as White House counsel for President Clinton, and I think only 3% of her records were withheld during the confirmation process. I think that the number could be even less than that. And for Kavanaugh's staff secretary records to not be released to the Senate as like a full body and to the public, it raises major questions, not only for government transparency, but for the deference that we would give one administration over another.
Right.
They don't square up with each other. And it does make this conversation, this confirmation process seem a bit more like political circus.
But he's also said that, you know, some of his views are informed by his work during that period. And if we're not getting access to that, and it's not as if the issues that he dealt with during that era, it's not as if those issues aren't going to be relevant to today just because it's, you know, a number of years later. You know, torture, you know, Fourth Amendment issues of detention, even, you know, some of the issues in the Bush administration on women's right to choose and other things. You know, those are all going to be relevant in his confirmation battle. And I'd like to give you a quote with respect to Kagan's confirmation. In order for the Senate to fulfill its constitutional responsibility of advising consent, we must get all her documents from the Clinton Library, have enough time to analyze them so we can determine whether she should be a justice. And that was Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley in 2010. But now he's obviously taking a different position. So it's somewhat frustrating, I think, and I agree with you on that position. The other thing that's somewhat interesting is that you know, here we have a rush to hold the hearings and get him confirmed before the midterm elections, whereas and 2 years ago we were told that we couldn't confirm someone so close to elections. And you know, President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland was nominated 237 days before the election, whereas Kavanaugh was a mere 119 days. And so all of a sudden, one is okay and the other one's not. So those, I think those are some of the tensions that already have created you know, doubt on the on this nomination, just because of it's become politicized just by that alone.
I mean, exactly. To fully disclose, I was actually in the Obama White House during Merrick Garland's nomination and the Senate's failure to confirm. And so this is a little bit of a heartburn issue for me.
Yes, I can imagine. Now, jumping into the substance, though, we have a number of issues that you and your fellow EFF colleagues laid out. Asking questions about what he should be asked in the confirmation process, and you know, and despite the absence of certain records from his Bush era work, I mean, the judge does have 12 years of, you know, published opinions, and I think the one area that jumps out to a lot of people in the tech community is net neutrality. And what's your view on what we can glean from the judge's net neutrality opinion?
I mean, definitely. The net neutrality, his net neutrality opinion is really interesting for a bunch of different reasons. I mean, so he did issue the dissenting opinion, and so thankfully the DC second majority is what upheld the 2015 Open Internet Order, arguing that it, holding that the Open Internet Order wasn't arbitrary or capricious. What really stands out to me in Kavanaugh's dissenting opinion is his ruling on, or his interpretation of, the First Amendment. In net neutrality, you have two competing First Amendment interests: the interest of the ISPs that Kavanaugh supports in carrying content over their infrastructure, but then you also have the First Amendment rights of people online, and the way that Kavanaugh has chosen to balance those rights, I think, is really interesting, and will shed light on, if he is confirmed to the Supreme Court, the way he will balance corporate speech versus individual speech.
And just to highlight the procedural posture of that rule, his dissent, this was a case of which the Obama era open internet order had been affirmed by the DC Circuit in 2016. And now there was a petition to have an en banc review of the entire DC Circuit. That review, that request was denied. Kavanaugh dissented, and in two major grounds, one of which was the First Amendment. And I saw an article that addressed his First Amendment argument. Gigi San wrote a piece that, and she had worked with FCC Chairman Wheeler, and she said that his view that somehow, I think his language was that, because TV stations can air ESPN and they can air content, then ISPs are the same and they should be able to choose whether or not to broadcast ESPN, just like TV companies can choose broadcast ESPN. And they thought that this was a kind of a fringe of First Amendment jurisprudence, and it ignored the role of being a public provider in this space. I think her quote was, for 85 years, First Amendment rights on network operators like ISPs, broadcasters, and cable operators have always balanced with the rights of the public. And Kavanaugh's ascension to the bench could start the mainstreaming of a legal theory that would all but eviscerate the public's rights with regard to networks that use of public rights of way and by law are required to serve the republic. And he was really out there on the First Amendment.
He is really out there, especially when you consider kind of the technical distinctions between broadcast television cable companies and telephone and ISPs. So broadcast companies, they actually have to pay for the content that they choose to then offer as packages. So when you have a DirecTV subscription, DirecTV actually has to pay for HBO and pay for HGTV. Whereas telephone companies, they don't do that. Internet companies certainly don't pay out subsidies to Netflix and to New York Times, for the hosting of the content. So there's actually, that his idea that there is choice, within what ISPs carry is kind of detached from the marketplace reality that happens in the cable context.
And he was also criticized. He also took the position that there really was no authority, that Congress hadn't specified authority for the FCC to take the action, and ignoring a Supreme Court decision that held that there was authority to regulate in the space. And so that was also troubling to some.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is a common thread in some of his opinions, which, I mean, it's why I think the legal community has quite a few concerns about his nomination. Still hoping that he will, if confirmed to the bench, that he will apply the law the way that justices are supposed to do. But his lower court opinions, they raise a lot of concerns for that.
Another big area, and by the way, we should point out that if confirmed, Judge Kavanaugh would be the second youngest justice on the court. Only one younger is the latest justice, Justice Gorsuch.
Yeah.
So you have, you know, Trump nominating the two youngest justices on the Supreme Court who could be there for 30 years. And so he's been criticized in net neutrality. But then one of the areas you guys tackled was in privacy. Well, take us through your view of his jurisprudence in that area.
Yeah, so he has Orrin Kerr has established a few more Fourth Amendment cases, but as far as Kavanaugh's Fourth Amendment and privacy, Fourth Amendment and digital rights jurisprudence,
right,
he has two main cases. So he authored a dissenting opinion in U.S. v. Maynard, which is actually U.S. v. Jones. It went to the Supreme Court as U.S. v. Jones. And he authored a concurrence in the D.C. Circuit's decision to not take up a rehearing in Clayman, which is the NSA Section 215 case. So it's privacy in two different landscapes. So there's a law enforcement privacy and national security privacy. So I'm going to start with law enforcement. In Kavanaugh's opinion in Maynard, which is Jones, his dissenting opinion, he strongly supports,
It was dissenting, yeah.
Okay. He strongly supports a property-based theory for searches, which is actually what you see Scalia take up in Scalia's opinion in Jones. However, the plurality in Jones upholds the reasonable expectation of privacy and actually discusses the long-term privacy intrusions of persistent surveillance that was conducted through the GPS monitoring. It's a little concerning that he dismissed the reasonable expectation of privacy, that he wants to ground law enforcement privacy intrusions solely in the property theories. The latest case that the Supreme Court has ruled on this in this area is Carpenter. Carpenter supports the plurality in Jones, articulating that the long-term collection of records increases privacy harms and is therefore considered a search. So I'd be interested in seeing how Kavanaugh squares his opinion in his D.C. Circuit opinion in Jones with the recent ruling in Carpenter.
We're going to take a short break right now. We'll come back to Carpenter and the Jones ruling as well as the Clayman opinion after these messages. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Content Marketing World 2018 comes to Cleveland, Ohio, September 4th through the 7th. Learn more at contentmarketingworld.com. Content Marketing World 2018 is the one event where you will learn and network with the best and brightest in the content marketing industry. Content Marketing World will have over 120 sessions and workshops presented by the leading brand marketers and experts from around the world, covering strategy, storytelling, ROI, demand generation, AI, and more. Leave Cleveland with all the materials you need to build a content marketing plan that will grow your business and inspire your audience. Save $100 off of registration using promo code RADIO100. That's radio and the number 100. Don't miss Content Marketing World 2018 in Cleveland, Ohio, September 4th through the 7th. Register now at contentmarketingworld.com.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
It's time once again to get ready for the 35th Annual Miami Book Fair, November 11th through the 18th. Learn more at MiamiBookFair.com. Over 500 authors will be coming in from all over the world to read their books, answer questions from the audience, and sign autographs. Award-winning luminaries confirmed to attend this year include novelists like Elliot Ackerman, Robert Olin Butler, Ingrid Rojas Contreras, and Deborah Dean. Nonfiction writers like Dr. Mark Agronin, Muhammad Al-Samawi, Andrea Barnett, and Tina Brown. Celebrities like Justine Bateman, Steve Kornacki, Bill Press. These are just a few of the confirmed 500 authors scheduled to appear at the 2018 Miami Book Fair, November 11th to the 18th. Check out the full schedule of events right now at MiamiBookFair.com. That's MiamiBookFair.com.
WebmasterRadio.fm. Welcome to the place your competitors get their edge. Jump on it. We're here for you 24/7.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and just a brief shout-out. Happy 79th birthday to Boston legend Carl Yastrzemski. And but before we broke, we were talking about the ruling in U.S. v. Jones and subsequent Supreme Court decision that relied on all kind of a privacy-based determination of a property-based determination on privacy. Because in that case, in Jones, involved the use of a GPS device to track someone's car over an extended week, several weeks, I think, in violation of the terms of the warrant that they had. And ultimately, it was overturned by saying that not because of the privacy interest of the individual, but because it had been intruded the property of the car in which the defendant was using. And so you were just talking about that and in the latest decision, Supreme Court decision in Carpenter.
Yes. So in Jones, as you said, in Jones, there is the facts create kind of like a strong property theory that the police affixed a GPS tracker to someone's car, their physical property, and then tracked them for a period of time. So Scalia's opinion in Jones actually draws on some of Kavanaugh's draws on a similar theory that Kavanaugh wrote in his dissenting in the D.C. Circuit, that the property interests actually constitute the help establish the search. But the plurality with Sotomayor and Justice Alito still upholds and supports the reasonable expectation of privacy theory that has been part of the U.S. Fourth Amendment jurisprudence since the 70s. And so the Supreme Court's latest ruling in Carpenter, I mean, the facts are just very different. In Carpenter, the law enforcement went to a to a telecommunications service provider to get all of the historic cell site location records of the criminal defendant. And ultimately the Supreme Court held that these detailed long-term records of a person constitutes a Fourth Amendment search, even though these records are held by a third party. So you don't actually have that same kind of property interest that you would in U.S. v. Jones, where someone has actually affixed something to your physical to a physical object that you own. And so I think it would be really interesting to see how Kavanaugh actually kind of like squares up his opinion in Jones that supports the property theory with what you see in the modern world, where people don't necessarily have complete control of the data or of the property, and there are these kind of like quasi-ownership schemes with companies. So some of the questions that we'd want to ask Kavanaugh are, I mean, do you believe in the reasonable expectation of privacy, or do you think it's a failed experiment, as Justice Thomas said in his dissent in the Carpenter opinion, or have him expound on his view on property, because in Justice Gorsuch's dissent in the Kavanaugh in the Carpenter opinion, he supported a property theory that goes a little bit further than the one that Scalia articulated in Jones. But I actually think one huge question of how user rights and this property theory don't necessarily mesh is within terms of service agreements. And does Kavanaugh actually view the ability to does Kavanaugh think that people can contract away the privacy rights, essentially?
Right. And that's going to be an important decision, especially as we move forward with states enacting different various privacy laws as well. Now, in a related case in the privacy is this ruling in Clayman, which involved a review of the National Security Agency's warrantless mass telephone surveillance program. And as an aside point, because Kavanaugh said during his confirmation process that he had not been involved in these issues when he was staff secretary for President Bush, he did not recuse himself from any of these type of cases as they came before him. And so I think, you know, whatever the record is on whether or not he was involved in these issues while he was with the Bush administration raises questions about whether he should have recused himself because of that past involvement. But in any event, so in Clayman, you have a case that comes before him regarding the collection of telephony metadata. Tell us about that ruling.
Yeah, so in Clayman, the procedural posture is a little weird, but where Kavanaugh actually issued his kind of concurring opinion was the Clayman requested a rehearing en banc from the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit denied. And they just issued, I think, like a one-sentence order denying the rehearing. But Kavanaugh actually issued this like two-page concurring opinion on the denial of rehearing. For two pages, he packs a lot in there. And I think these two pages are probably the most concerning for all privacy advocates in Kavanaugh's nomination. So first, Kavanaugh holds that because of the third-party doctrine, the NSA telephony metadata program is perfectly legal and and abides by the Fourth Amendment.
Could you explain the third-party doctrine for our listeners?
Yeah. So the third party doctrine is this doctrine from the 1970s. And it actually goes back to a case, Smith v. Maryland, where the government requested the numbers that someone put in on the telephone from the telephone company. And so the third party doctrine essentially establishes that if you willingly give over information to a third party, to a company like AT&T or to any telephone service provider, that you have given up your privacy rights because they actually have control of that information. And the government can request that information from these third party providers without a warrant. And so Kavanaugh believes in the NSA context that because you dial numbers on your cell phone and AT&T and Verizon track how long you have called people, how often you have called people, and have detailed records of this, that that information that you have given over to your telephone service provider, you have willingly done so, and that the government doesn't need a warrant for it. And that, I mean, that's troubling. Luckily, the case, the Wooling and Carpenter that just happened, kind of chips away at this third-party doctrine viewpoint. So the cell site location information in Carpenter was held by telephone service providers, the same as the telephone numbers in Smith v. Maryland. But the Supreme Court in Carpenter distinguished the two cases and said that because of the modern world and because of how much information is collected, it creates a much higher privacy harm. And so it will be interesting to see how Kavanaugh views the third-party doctrine in light of the Carpenter opinion, and especially because he's going to be on the court with eight justices who just authored this opinion.
Right.
And so will he actually, like, defer to his colleagues' wisdom? But the thing that actually concerns me more about Kavanaugh's opinion in Clayman is that he ruled that even if it would be considered a search for the NSA to get records from a third party, that the government's special needs to monitor the national security of the nation overrules the individual privacy harms. And that is an over expansive view of this doctrine, which hasn't been fully fleshed out, and I think concerns a lot of privacy advocates in our more modern world, where the intelligence community has these vast capabilities. Since the Patriot Act, the big question is like, what is not a special need for national security?
Right?
Can the intelligence community and even law enforcement just essentially do whatever as long as they articulate special needs?
And he has been criticized on this point, both from the left and the right. Senator Wyden, you know, a Democrat from Oregon, said that his decisions on mass surveillance and warrantless tracking of Americans' every move are out of step with both the Fourth Amendment and the court's recognition that digital devices are different. And then Republican Congressman Justin Amash says, future decisions on the constitutional government surveillance will be huge. We can't afford a rubber stamp for the executive branch. And in this sense, in the context of those privacy rulings and the net neutrality rulings, as well as the immigration rulings, which I don't know if you've looked at, but that had led the San Jose Mercury to conclude that Justice Kavanaugh would be a disaster for the technology industry and users of tech products.
So justices can always surprise you.
True.
Eisenhower appointed both Warren and Warren and someone else.
Brennan.
And he expected them to be conservatives, and here they were issuing in like the liberal anti really anti-police abuse kind of heyday of the Supreme Court. And so Kavanaugh could always surprise you. However, I think someone's past actions and past speech, if you'd consider an opinion speech, is kind of indicative of their thoughts and where they'll go in the future. And so, I mean, based entirely on his past actions, it is a bit terrifying, especially because of his views on the special needs doctrine. I mean, on things like the third party doctrine and on like the property based theories of privacy. You can be comforted in a way that Carpenter has already come out, and Carpenter has really kind of like set the stage for where the Supreme Court is in this current moment. And so the question will be, will Kavanaugh help the Supreme Court continue to shape this area of jurisprudence, or will he be kind of like a stumbling block and help slow it down?
One stumbling block we have is we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more on Justice Kavanaugh's nomination after these messages. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
The Web Marketing Association is now accepting entries for its 7th Annual International Mobile Web Award Competition. This award program is an opportunity for mobile developers to demonstrate their expertise in this growing medium. It recognizes the individual and team achievements of web professionals all over the world who create and maintain outstanding responsive and mobile websites and mobile applications. Deadline for entry is September 28, 2018. Submit your entry today at www.mobile-webaward.org. That's mobile-webaward.org. Ready to do a podcast for your business? Make that podcast elevate to enterprise level. Let webmasterradio.fm expedite and execute your podcast to build your brand and broaden your customer base. Webmasterradio.fm has worked with the world's biggest tech brands, Google, Yahoo, and Bing, and have worked with fast-growing brands like ShipStation and GoDaddy. Now it's your turn. Contact BRASCO at WMR.FM and rush your enterprise-level podcast into production at a very reasonable rate. Email BRASCO at WMR.FM.
WebmasterRadio.FM. Get addicted. Get ahead.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking about the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to be Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. And we've been talking about this is views on privacy as well as his net neutrality rulings. And Camille, have you looked at his immigration rulings at all?
I actually haven't. I have your article pulled up about immigration.
I mean, basically, he took the position that illegal immigrants, in a labor law context, that were not persons. They did not count. And it involves a case that had certified and voted to elect a union, and then it turned out that there were illegal immigrants in the workforce. So he said, therefore, the election was invalid. And in doing so, he kind of ignored precedent. And that's the other troubling part, is there seems to be a repeated ignoring of precedent. But one area you did touch on was in competition law. And then there, he's also being criticized for being, in both cases, he approved mergers that had a very deferential view to the business, and it ignored arguments that in terms of what the merger being anti-competitive.
Yeah. I mean, so competition is an area that EFF has recently started to get into, just because every issue that we work on, whether it's privacy or copyright rights or, I mean, free speech rights online, the kind of the rise of large technology players is, I mean, truly impacting individual user rights online. And so Kavanaugh's deference to the companies over the American marketplace or the American consumer it's troubling. Even in his net neutrality ruling, I mean, he essentially says that the only thing that will kind of usurp the company's free speech rights and carrying whatever they want to on the internet or doing whatever they want to with their service is if you can truly show that ISPs are in a geographic monopoly. However, I think he also supports the idea that wireless internet service can compete with wireline broadband service. And I mean, there are tons of economists that show that those just completely separate services, they're servicing a different need in a different market.
Sure.
And so, I mean, antitrust is so fact dependent on like what particular economists you can get on your side. But it is troubling that as we continue down this path where large technology companies are kind of gobbling up data and don't always like share very well with each other and are, rather than allowing new entrants into the market, just buying them up.
Right.
I think antitrust is the kind of area of law that has the potential to like most shape our future. And it is kind of troubling that that Kavanaugh has so fully supported the companies.
We actually had a guest on our show recently talk about, you know, because the role of antitrust in tech has become a hot button issue, and as evidenced by the fact that EFF is now focusing on it, and that there's a history of basically, you know, antitrust enforcement actually leading to innovation. By breaking up these behemoths, you spin off companies that are now free to compete, and throughout history, it's led to greater innovation. And you know, we're at this point now where you have a very few companies controlling the main components of the internet infrastructure and internet system, and there's a danger in that.
I mean, there is a danger of that in that. So Microsoft actually was hit by some of the early day antitrust in tech suits. And it's why we have such competition in the software industry. What I think is going to be increasingly troubling is competition within the AI marketplace, because AI so heavily relies on large data sets to train an algorithm. And if you don't have competition, you're going to continue seeing things like Amazon's facial recognition program that misidentifies Black congressmen, or that kind of loops racial minorities all into one category. The early reports from Google, where Google was matching African American persons with primates.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And you need competition so that companies have the incentive to be better, and so that these things don't happen.
And so we only have a few minutes left. In general, if you had one question for Judge Kavanaugh, what would your question be?
My question would kind of go back to executive power, and would go back to the special needs doctrine, and it would just ask him, at what point do you think that the American, the individual American interest outweighs the overarching national security interest? Because the way that the Constitution was set up and the way that the Fourth Amendment is set up is that the individual interests should override the interests of the state. And I think that he misbalances the way we've set up our government.
Which is ironic, because basically the whole Federalist Society, Heritage Foundation type justices are wear this mantle of original intent, and the whole Fourth Amendment, even the Fifth, and the being drawn and quartered, and all those having to house troops. I forget what amendment that is, but their reaction to excessive government authority. And to be so deferential to a large state, given these rights, would seem to be inconsistent with someone who says he's following original intent.
It very much does. It actually it raises questions for me why Senator Paul hasn't publicly questioned Kavanaugh's record more. Because Senator Paul has been a champion for this kind of originalist intent and individual rights, civil rights of the state, especially in the Fourth Amendment context. Questions by the Heritage Center and large conservative, maybe libertarian groups are actually putting forth a nominee that is so entrenched in the idea of executive power and executive privilege.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, was he involved with, did he opine, or was he behind some of the Bush signing statements where, when you could sign a law and then issue a statement more or less overriding congressional intent?
He is. I'm not sure to the extent that he did so in Bush, but he has been on the record saying that if the president finds something to be a law to be unconstitutional, then the president had the full authority just to not enforce the law, which raises huge concerns for the American checks and balance system.
Right, and the oath of office to faithfully uphold the law. And, there is that minor detail. So we only have a few minutes left. If people want to learn more about you and what you're doing at the EFF, where should they go?
So you can go to our website. It's EFF.org. We have been a champion of digital rights since the 90s. So if you want to learn anything about our work, we do extensive work in the anti-surveillance space and copyright intellectual property. And as I mentioned earlier, we have a new project on antitrust and how to champion user rights in our digital age.
Well, thank you very much. This is a very important nomination, and we appreciate the EFF's works and insights in this regard. So thank you again and for joining us. Sadly, I have to issue another in memoriam. A colleague of ours from the California Bar Lawyers Association IP section, he passed away at the age of 41. Chris Lockhart was taken by cancer, and there's a really nice tribute by his wife in The Athletic, and you can see the show notes for details on that, but our sympathies go to Chris and his family. It's just he's a nice guy. It's sad to see him go so soon. So thank you again, Amy, and Camille. I'm sorry. Thank you, Camille, and it's been great having you. And join us next week for another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report, only here on WebmasterRadio.fm. Have a good week, everyone.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm.